I'm going to talk about something more or less the same as what Pavel was saying this morning, characterization of the sigma b1 consequences of bounded arithmetic. But I'll focus on some theories lower down, T12 and T22, maybe T32 if there's time, and present what seems like quite a nice characterization of the consequences of those, and not say really say anything about the general case. So a lot of my introduction was covered by things that Pavel was saying. But so there's three parts really to the talk. I want to define this new principle, this new characterization, which is colored PLS. I want to say something about the proof of why it characterizes what it does, which will involve talking about resolution and a certain kind of reflection principle for resolution, one reflection for resolution, which is maybe something new. And then, if there's time, I'll carry on to talk about another characterization in terms of something I'm calling recursion programs. And these three parts actually correspond to three different principles that, that characterize these things. So, just to repeat something that Pavel was saying, by a search problem, I mean a true for all sigma b1 statement sentence. So a trivial example would be something like, for all x exists y, fx equals y, where f is polynomial time. And I'm not going to worry very much about writing down bounds for these things, but generally these quantifiers are going to be bounded. So this is true, and the search principle of finding such a y given such an x is can be straightforwardly done in polynomial time. And this things of this class characterize sigma b1 consequences of T02, as Pavel was calling it. So a more interesting case is the sigma b1 consequences of T12. And again, we know this is doable by the PLS principle. So I'll write it down again since it gives me the opportunity to draw a picture. So an instance of PLS is going to be a size n and a domain D, which is a subset of 0 up to n, and the neighborhood function n. And PLS says that for any number n and for any polynomial time things defining the domain and the neighbor, that either there is something in the domain whose neighbor is not in the domain, or there is something which is in the domain and the neighbor is not smaller than it. And I guess to make this into a, to make this true, we need to also assume that something, let's say n, is actually in the domain. So this is true because if these are the numbers from 0 up to n, then n is in D, the neighbor of n is in D, and we can keep on finding neighbors, and because we get to 0 at some point, we can't go on down forever. So there must be something where either the neighbor function takes you back up or it takes you out of the domain. And in general, what we have is some kind of graph, directed graph of out degree 1, that's always going down. We know it has one source element, n. Maybe it looks something like this. This bit goes to here. Maybe there's some other things that join up. Maybe there's a wholly separate path here where these things are all elements of the domain. And to solve PLS, all we have to do is find a single leaf. Notice it doesn't matter which one. This leaf is as much a solution as that leaf is. So part of CPLS is being a bit more particular about which paths we consider. So this is provable in T12 because you can just prove it by minimalization. You just find the least x in the domain, and then this must be a leaf. So CPLS is going to be a slightly more complex version of this, so I better write it over here. Oh, so by the way, I think I'll call this an instance of a problem. So search problems consist of a class of instances, and this is an instance because we fixed the D and the N, the big N, and we fixed the little N, and we have to find a single X. So an instance of CPLS, so this is colored PLS, of size N, has a domain D. It has a source node N, which is in the domain, and there are leaves L, there's a neighborhood function N, and there's sets of colors C. So let's write this down. So there's a set L of leaves. Each non-leaf has a neighbor. And each I has a set of colors, CI. And then one of these must fail. So I'm going to write down a contradiction. One is that for all non-leafs, the neighbor is smaller than the leaf. Another one is that for all non-leafs, the colors of the neighbor are a subset of the colors of the leaf.
Element.
Of the element, of the node. And three is for all leaves, there is a particular color that belongs to the set of colors. So actually, this is another function that belongs to the description. It's got each leaf has a color. So it's a polynomial time map from the leaves to colors. And four, the colors of the source are empty. So this is probably best illustrated by a picture like the PLS one. So we've got the numbers from 0 up to n.
Are the colors the number between 0 and n?
Yes. So the color, the set of colors is potentially quite big. So is that everything? Yep. So here is the root, the source, and it has a neighbor, and generally it goes on down, and at some point it's got to run out of neighbors and get to a leaf just by PLS. Then there might be other paths coming into this, and there might be other disjointed paths. And we know that if this is node, if the leaf is node 1, say, then this has got a color E1. And if this is 2, then this has got a color E2. And similarly, this has got a color, maybe E4. So this is this. Every node has a color.
CN is empty. As you go down, you lose color. So how can
as you go down, so as you go up from the bottom, you'd never lose a color. So every node on this path must have a color E1. So this is why it's a contradiction. So maybe a better way to look at it is something like, it's a search problem where given 1, 2, and 3, find a color for N. So you solve this problem by starting at the root, finding a path down, finding the color here, then taking the color back up. Or another alternative formulation would be given 1, 2, and 4, find a leaf without its given color. So this is just writing these differently. Sorry. Yes.
So I think to be a different class, the color function has to be just described as a relation. If it were given as an explicit function, you could just define a subdomain of things that have no colors.
You mean this function E?
No, C.
So this is just a polynomial time set for each, so it's uniform.
So it's a
set.
Relation yes. Between the nodes and the colors.
Yes.
So if it were, well, your notation seems like it's, okay.
No,
it's you can have a, if you had a polynomial time mm-hmm. listing of all the possible colors, then this would just be in PLF.
Yep. But you haven't got that. Potentially it's some very large set of colors. So, I mean, really this is just some binary relation, a table that for each node has the, tells you if that color belongs to that node or not. So, the idea is it's something like PLS, except either you can think of it as you have to go down a path to find a leaf, get a color at the leaf, and then take the color back up to find a color for N, or you can think of it as you're interested in finding a leaf, but not just any one. You want one that's similar enough to the root that it doesn't have any colors, or doesn't have some particular one. Okay. So, and as we said, if you have a small number of colors, or if you have only one color, then this becomes equivalent to PLS. So, it's a theorem that the class of all such problems is reducible to, or the other way around, to the sigma B1 consequences of T22. And what's more, this reducibility can be carried out in PV, so this tells you something about axiomatizing the consequences of T22 as well. So this direction is easy, because we can just do it by T22 induction. Because we just show that we look at this sentence, for all j less than I, node j actually has a color. So this is for all, this is pi b2, and just by looking at this picture, if all the nodes below this have at least one color, we want to find a color for this one. Either it's a leaf when we know a color for it, or it has a neighbor below this line whereby the inductive hypothesis, we have a color for it, so we can always find a color for it. So a straightforward induction, if you assume 1, 2, and 3, it gives you the negation of 4. So that's straightforward. The other direction is rather harder and will involve some more definitions and going through this principle of reflection for resolution, one reflection for resolution. So I'll give those definitions and go on to that now. So, first of all, let me just say something about, a bit of a digression on T22 and resolution. So, supposing we know that T22 with the relativized version with an undefined relation symbol proves something of this form. And we fix, we want to convert this into a propositional proof. So we fix some value for x. So fix a value a for x. And then by the Parris-Wilkie translation that Arnold was talking about, we get a depth 2.5, you could call it, LK proof of this, of size quasi-polynomial in A, where the variables are the bits of alpha. So the variables look like xij, where this is going to be equivalent more or less to alpha ij. So the things that were just in the normal language of arithmetic vanish, and we get some proof that just talks about the oracle, since normally this sort of thing is proving something about the oracle. And it's an old result of Jan Krychek that the proof, when you do this Parris-Wilkie translation, you get a proof in such a nice form that you can do a couple of things to it and actually make it into a resolution refutation of, so the Parris-Wilkie thing would give a proof of something like this. So this is meant to be the translation into a propositional formula. So Parris-Wilkie gives a proof of this that's not too big, and Krychek's argument gives a resolution, well, a res-log refutation of the negation of this looked at as a set of clauses. So you get a not too big res-log refutation of this set of clauses. Again, in these variables that I'm not writing here. So what I'm about to describe for resolution is a similar kind of translation from proofs here into resolution refutations, but with three changes. So here, in this construction, we're not really concerned with the complexity of the final object, just with its size. And we imagine writing it down, allowing ourselves as much time as we want for doing it, and we get a finished object. So we're not going to do that. We're going to show that you can actually get a polynomial time resolution refutation. So it's not a single string. It's a polynomial time thing with some parameters such that you can ask it what there is at a certain place in the proof and it'll tell you. Another change is that we're not going to end up with a refutation that starts from big clauses like this. We're going to end up with one that starts with narrow clauses. I'll say why that's important later. And lastly, we're not going to do it for a relativized case. We're going to do it for the unrelativized case. So in this case, all the things that just belong to the language of arithmetic vanish, and you just get the oracle left over. But we want to talk about even unrelativized things, so that's not going to happen. So we end up with something maybe slightly odd as the variables. But I'll come on to that in a bit. So I said an older connection with resolution, and I'm going to describe a new one in a minute. But first of all, I'm just going to define how these polynomial time resolution refutations work, and say what this is, and just show that this principle is reducible to this, and then, so what are we doing for production? So I've shown that the sigv1 principles of T22 are that CPLS is reducible to that, and I'm about to show that this is reducible to this, and then I'll show the last one, and then go on to something else with this time. So I said we're going to construct, from a T22 proof like this, we're going to construct a polynomial time resolution refutation. And that's defined pretty much as you'd expect. So we have to say how we define clauses and then say how we define proofs. So a clause is a set of literals. So if we have literals, say, x1 up to xa, where a is a large number rather than a length, and we also have literals x not x1 up to not xa, then we just look at this as the interval from 0 up to 2a, and a clause is just the polynomial time subset of this interval that contains some true literals and some negated literals. And a refutation is just going to be a table, a long table, of clauses and some polynomial time set that says which literals are in which clause. So I'll run this out to draw a table. So if there's A literals, then there's going to be A along here and A along here. The first rows are going to be the initial clauses. And the rest of it is going to be the refutation. And let's say this is a length M and this is length N. So the initial clauses are coded by a polynomial time subset of this, and the refutation itself is coded as a polynomial time subset of this. And so we've said what all the clauses are, and now we have to say what's resolved from what. So we also have a function f that contains all the information about the resolution steps. So if if clause I here was derived from clause, let's say, J1 here and clause J2 here, then the function f, if you give it input I, it tells you what the two clauses it was derived from, and it also tells you which literal. So maybe this is not xi, and this is xk, and this is xk. So f, it takes as input I, and it gives you the triple j1, j2, and k, which is all you need to know about the resolution step. And we'll also allow f, maybe it, what if it wasn't derived by resolution, maybe it was derived by weakening. So we have a special case for that. And for it to be a refutation, there's one more thing you need, which is that the last line is empty. So a resolution refutation, polynomial time, is a triple, R, S, F, such that these things are clauses, such that F encodes the correct reputation steps, and such that the last line is empty. Now, the statement that something... So this is a reputation. That statement is pi b1. Because we don't have to say anything exists, we just have to describe certain fixed properties of the object. And if alpha is a p-time assignment, so just an assignment of zeros and ones to the variables from x1 up to xa, then R is not satisfied by alpha is... sigma b2. Because we have to say that there is some clause, so some line in the table R in which every literal is false. So this is sigma b2. But if we make an extra assumption about the nature of this reputation, which is if we assume that all the initial clauses are narrow, so each initial clause only contains polynomially many literals, and those literals are given somehow in polynomial time, then we can do this in a sigma b1 way, because the statement that all the literals are false shrinks from being pi b1 just to being polynomial time. So this statement, if RSF is a p-time refutation of narrow initial clauses R, and alpha is a p-time assignment, then some clause in R is false in alpha, this is now sigma b1. Because a witness to it is a witness that this fails to be a refutation, which is just a sigma b1 thing. I guess this can't really fail to be an assignment, or it's a single clause, and then we can check that that clause is false in polynomial time, because we're given, I haven't really defined it, but the force of narrow here is that for each clause in R, we're given a list in polynomial time of its literals. So we can check in polynomial time that it's false, so this is sigma b1. So this principle is what I've called one reflection for resolution. And the one in the one reflection reflects the fact that we have narrow initial clauses, which corresponds somehow to... which is the refutational equivalent of considering the sigma b1 things provable in a theory. So, this is a fairly straightforward principle, just formulated in, I guess, a fairly straightforward fashion, but with these larger proofs than normal. And I'm claiming that you can obtain this by a simple reduction to colored PLS. So I've got to say what my graph is and what my colors are and how it follows. So let me say it here. So the graph is just an upside down reputation. So we think of refutation like this, with the empty clause at the top, and with all the initial clauses at the bottom. And so we have this function f that from some clause C here in the middle, it gives you the two clauses from which C was derived by resolution. So maybe this is dx, x is bad, maybe this is du, and this is e, not u. So this is the structure we've got there just written upside down. And then the nodes are clauses. The colors of a node I are the false literals in, no, they're the true literals. The true literals in the clause I. So this means that, for example, the empty clause at the bottom of the proof is the right thing to correspond to the source here, because it doesn't contain any true literals. It doesn't contain any literals in at all, and in particular, it doesn't contain any true literals. The leaves, the initial clauses, and the neighbor of I, we go in the direction of the false literal. So if we have this case where from C, where C was obtained by resolution from du and from eu, e not u, if this is node I, then if u is false, then the neighbor of C is this clause, and if u is true, then we go the other way, the neighbor of C is this clause. And we also have to say how we can obtain, how we know that each leaf has a color. So to do this, the point of this principle is to find a false initial clause. So well, there's various ways of doing it, but we can just assume for contradiction that all the initial clauses are in fact satisfied. And then because they're all narrow, we can actually find a true literal for them in polynomial time, since we can just look through each literal in the clause and we know that one of them must be true. So we can do all these things. And do we satisfy these three things? So certainly the neighbor always takes us further down or further up the proof. We can find a true literal in each clause because we're assuming there's no false clause. There's no literals at all in the root, so certainly no true literals. And just the condition that for every internal node, when we go from the node to its neighbor, we don't add any new colors. Well, the colors here are just the true literals. And the neighbor of C, we always go in the direction of adding a false literal. So we're never going to add any true literals. And so this condition on colors is maintained. So this makes an instance of this into an instance of colored PLS. And we'll consider PLS in this form, color PLS in this form, and it says that we can find a leaf that doesn't have the color we claim it has. And so this is exactly finding a initial clause that didn't have the true literal we thought it did. So in fact, it won't have any true literal at all. Since they're all small enough, we can check all these things. Okay. So that's the simple thing. The more complex one is to go all the way around here and show that any instance of this problem can be done in, can be reduced to this reflection principle for resolution. So it'll be a matter of translating T22 proofs into resolution refutations. So I'll try and do that very quickly. Thank you. So we start off with a T22 proof of something for all sigma B1. And we want to plug in a particular value, A for X, and we want to end up with a resolution refutation of this. So we want to end up with a resolution refutation that more or less starts off with some translations of the negation of these things. So it's going to be clauses not beta A Y. However we translate this, it's going to be clauses here for each Y. So this looks a bit odd. Maybe I'll just say, so we want a refutation of this universal thing. So from the proof here, we want a refutation of this, and then each one of these is going to translate into a clause, so the refutation of this universal statement is a refutation with a family of clauses. So I've got to say how we do this translation, and then just say something about the construction of the proof. If we fix A and assume T is the bound on all quantifiers in the proof, pi, where pi is our proof here, then we have to say what the variables are going to be in this resolution refutation. So for each sharply bounded subformula phi occurring in the proof, and each tuple b of numbers less than t, this thing is a literal. So normally, in this kind of translation, like the Paris-Wilkie translation, for each, for the one or two relation symbols, for each pair of parameters that could occur in that symbol, you make that into a literal. But here we haven't got any relation symbol, and we don't have the time to calculate whether these sentences are true or not, because if we look at any single one of these, we can tell immediately whether it's true or false. But we can't do that to the whole proof at once. So we actually make them into our literals. So you could do this by having a literal for each atomic sentence with the parameters that will appear in the proof. And then that would look very like the Paris-Wilkie translation, but it's easier to allow all sharply bounded sentences. So those are our literals, and we need to describe how we make a proof out of them. So I'll just give the idea. Which is that we may assume that pi is free cut free, which is just an appeal to a certain form of a completeness theorem, which means that each sequent in pi So we're assuming pi is written in some sort of sequent calculus, has the form various clauses of this form on the left and various clauses of the same form on the right. So these will be bounded, but I'm not writing the bounds. So by the free cup free completeness theorem and this kind of cut elimination, we can assume that everything is pi 2, every sequence of the proof. And our inductive hypothesis is that for each such sequence in pi, for each choice z of parameters, so these might contain some parameters that I haven't written here, there exists a p-time resolution derivation. Well, I'll say what that is. But the derivation will depend on the parameters, and its initial clauses will be the translations of these, and its final clauses will be the translations of these. So the initial clauses is going to be a set of what you'd expect to be the translations there. And the final clauses are going to be a set of the natural translations of these. And you also have all these, well, so it's more general than this since you have more than one formula there. But that just makes it rather complicated, so I won't say anything about that. So we have this, and we also need some extra clauses at the start, helper clauses. So the main point of it is that we can derive the right-hand side from the left-hand side by resolution derivation, where this means it's like a resolution refutation, but we just don't end up with the empty clause. We start off with some clauses, we do some resolution steps, and we end up with some other final clauses, not necessarily the empty ones. Because of our choice of literals, these, for each different choice of parameters in different sentence, you get disjoint literals. So really these literals aren't related to each other. So we need to bring in some extra sort of small true clauses that just tell you some of the basic facts about arithmetic. But there's no time to say much about those. But these aren't a problem. And these give you, so you get these, the derivation of this from this, and then the proof that you can actually do this and inductively do this for each step just involves looking at the proof pi and showing that for each rule of the calculus that you apply, you can make one of these for the next line. So I'll do one case, which is for induction. So suppose we're processing the proof pi and making resolution derivations for each line, and we get to a step where the sigma 2 induction rule was appealed to. So we have some side formulas here, and then we'd have something like this. All x exists y, phi s x y implies all x some y, phi s plus 1 x y, and some other side formulas, and then we get this. So the inductive hypothesis tells us that for each s, we've got a, and uniformly in S as well. So everything here is polynomial time, uniform in all the inputs, apart from pi, but certainly uniform in the parameters. So for each S, we have a derivation pi S of the translation of this, from the translation of this. So to get a derivation of this from this, all we need to do is string all these proofs together. And since these were given uniformly in polynomial time, we can define a polynomial time derivation that just contains all of these. So we define a new proof as pi s, and then pi s plus 1, and so on, starting from pi 0 and going down to pi t minus 1. And so this will start off with these at the top here. It'll have all these things in the middle, but they'll all sort of cancel each other out, and then it will end up with these things at the bottom. So it's more complicated than this, because you have to deal with these side formulas. So you have to do some tricks to make every line look the same so they all fit together. But this can all be done fairly straightforwardly by some weakening. So that's how you deal with the induction case, and the other ones aren't so bad. And you also need, at some point, to start introducing these helper clauses to actually tell you how your variables are related to each other. And so just to summarize this part. So the basic step is we start off with a T22 proof of this. We make that into a derivation, free cut, free derivation that ends in this line. So this is just doing some proof theoretic manipulation. We get from proof of this, we get something that just ends in line. From this, we can derive the empty clause. And then we apply this translation into resolution derivations, and we end up with a resolution derivation that ends with the translation of this, which is the empty clause, and it starts with the translations of these, which is all these clauses. Together with some auxiliary clauses that we're not too worried about. And then our assignment is just the natural assignment that given any literal gives you its truth value, which we can always tell since the literals are just these sharply bounded sentences. We've made sure that the auxiliary clauses are always true under our assignment because we did that when we introduced them. And so the one reflection resolution will give you, if you give it the description, so the instance of one reflection for resolution that's given by this proof will be a search problem, any solution of which is some false initial clause, but none of these are false, so we get one of these must be false. So one reflection for resolution gives you a false literal like this, which implies that theta AY is true. So we start off with the assumption that T22 proves for all X, for some Y, this is true, and then we do something, and then we apply an instance of one reflection resolution, and we get some Y such that this is true. So this completes the picture here. And we get that all these things are equivalent.
Yeah.
I did the other direction?
No, you've got your...
Oh, the other way around, yeah. So... All right, so there's just time to talk about another characterization of these things that... I quite like, and is more robust, maybe, and also gives you a new way to look at PLS. So, I'll write it here.
Well, Neil, one question. Before you raise it, you haven't said anything that these clauses are narrow? These are narrow conditions?
So the only thing that has to be narrow is the initial clauses.
Yeah.
And the initial clauses are the translations. So the proof you get at the end of this construction corresponds to this. So the initial clauses will be the translation of these, and the final clause is empty. But this formula translates into a set of singleton clauses. And there's also the auxiliary clauses, but they're all narrow. Yeah, for the singletons, it's slightly unnatural there, but it works. So there's just a few minutes to give another characterization in terms of recursion programs. Well, I've written it there. So a recursion program of size n consists of a sequence pn down to p0 of polynomial time Turing machines, and a sequence theta n down to theta 0 of polynomial time correctness predicates. And more or less the job of each machine is given an input x to find a correct output y. And these machines are allowed to make recursive calls, but they can only make calls to things that are lower down. So PI can make calls to any PJ with J less than I. It can only make polynomially many such calls since it only has that much time. And the machine is well, program is well defined if so long as all the replies to its calls were correct, then its own output is correct. So, it's something like if PI calls PJ1. Well, that's not quite the right way to say it. So if PI receives correct replies, then the output of PI is correct. So this is a PiB1 statement, and it means that for any string describing a computation of PI with certain calls made and certain replies received, if the calls were, say, to some J and the reply satisfied theta J, then the final output of PI satisfies theta I. So we put in X as the input and put in Y as the output, and we can tell whether it's correct or not. So let's define CRP, which is totality of recursive programs, to be if this machine is well defined, then for all X, there's some y which is correct at the top. So this is true because we can prove in T22 that we can prove by induction on J that for all I less than J, for all inputs, there is a correct output. Because that's true at the bottom, because this machine can't make any calls at all, because it's got nothing to call. So by well-definedness, its output is always correct. And then if there's always a correct output for every input below some line, then we can simulate the input above the line and get correct outputs. So this is provable in T22, and it's also SIGMI1. And it's not hard to show that CPLS is reducible to this principle of totality. So so CPLS can be done using this, which is reducible to this. So the trick is that you don't really use X in the reduction, but you have a line in this program for each node, and correctness for that line is finding a color of that node. So what each machine tries to do is it tries to output of the color of the node it belongs to, and it can do this just by querying the neighbor, and if it finds a color for that, then it just passes that back up as an output. So really, this is reducible to a trivial case of this, and the other direction holds. So the interesting thing about this is that if you make the same definition, but you only allow logarithmically many machines, then this is equivalent to PLS. So you get quite a nice step up from PLS and T12 to T22 just by an exponential increase in the depth of these machines. And similarly, you can define a machine sort of one level up that we conjecture corresponds to the sigma V1 consequences of T32, that seems pretty likely. And if you just restrict that to logarithmic number of machines in the same way, then it corresponds to T22. So again, this gives the difference between T22 and T32 just in this exponential change in size. Yes, so we can define something very similar to this with just some extra Herbrand functions that characterizes the sigma V1 consequences of T32. And if you take that definition and you don't have machine 0 to n, but just machine 0 up to log n, then this characterizes the sigma V1 consequences of T22. So it looks like a useful sort of thing for proving some kind of separation result between these shallow and these exponentially deeper machines. But no luck with that so far. So, yes, and this is all joint work with Alan Skelly and Jan Krajicek. And I'll stop there.
Are there any questions? PLS was introduced as a complexity class because many natural problems, mm-hmm. you know, this was the home for many natural problems that you couldn't quite fit elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Can the same be said for CPLS? Are there natural problems that follow in CPLS?
Sort of. So no one really knows, I suppose apart from the pigeonhole principle, any problems that you can't do in T22, I think. And there are some that you can do, such as the weak pigeonhole principle is provable in T22, and you can get a reduction. Well, so it certainly is in this class of things in CPLS, and it's possible to write out a fairly straightforward reduction of it to this class. So there are things like that that live in it, but this is maybe the first nice example of something that seems complete for this class. So I don't think anything else is known that looks like it's another complete member of this class.
So there's no natural problem that you say is complete for CPLS? Other than reasoning in
no, not by now.
Thank you again for this wonderful...